Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. Thanks for joining me and my guests. It is time well spent to help you improve your product management skills. If you or your company wants to improve your skills further, I provide effective online training for many product management and innovation needs, helping product managers become product masters. Check out the training at the same place where you'll find the show notes for this episode, and that is theeverydayinnovator.com/111. Just click on the training link at the top of the page to see how you and your company can quickly become product masters. Now, a book recently caught my attention, and when I investigated the author, I was even more intrigued. The book is Building Insanely Great Products, and it was written by David Fradin. Now, David has trained thousands of managers throughout the world. He infuses his workshops with insights and experiences gained as a product leader at companies we might recognize like Apple and HP, Hewlett-Packard. In our discussion, you'll learn the 6 keys to building insanely great products, which can be remembered with the acronym SPICES. And that stands for Strategy, Process, Information, Customers, Employees, and Systems and Tools. I hope you find the interview valuable. David, thanks so much for joining the Everyday Innovator podcast.
Welcome. Glad to be with you.
I'm glad you took time for this. You have done a lot of work recently providing some really good resources. One of those is your book, Building Insanely Great Products. And I wanted to talk through the key elements of that with you. And in there, you share that there are 6 keys for building great products. And you use this acronym SPICES to help us remember it. And I don't have them memorized yet, so I got to look at my notes. SPICES is strategy, process, information, customers, employees, and system and tools. First, can you just share a little bit of your experience in terms of what led to developing those 6 keys?
Well, I was working with another product management and product marketing consulting company and helped write their training. And I designed for them an assessment of processes, product lifecycle processes. And I did one for GameSpot and I did one for Diebold. And I found that looking at just their planning, their framework, or their process and their artifacts, was what they talked about, didn't cover everything. In today's customer-centric businesses, we got to focus on the customer with making sure that we have all the competencies that are necessary in order to build insanely great products. The E in there had to be employees. Mm-hmm. And then having the systems and tools to get the job done. Many times people use whatever software they have available, like Excel, in order to make things nice and tidy in columns. But Excel was a spreadsheet, was never designed for the purpose of word processing or managing a business and that type of thing. And frequently we would have situations in the companies I worked at is that the sales force would not have an up-to-date version of the sales pitch or the sales deck or whatever. And you couldn't find, because the product manager's traveling someplace, the right sales deck. Mm-hmm. So it goes on and on and on. And that's why having the right systems and tools to help the product management process be done better is also essential.
A simple thing of version control, just knowing where latest version of something is, can drive us crazy. So this really came out of that experience with helping companies and then recognizing the things that they focused on didn't really provide the whole picture.
Exactly.
And you added those other elements. So let's talk about the whole picture. Where do you want to dive in? I guess we should start with S, since it's SPICES, and start with strategy.
Yeah, strategy is the strategy means the same thing as plan. So some people call it a product plan. Some people call it I call it a product market strategy. And there are 24 elements to that product market strategy. And about the first 15 of them, most companies skip and they go right into, for example, writing a value proposition or a positioning statement. And then they go right to messaging and launching the product. And then classic example of this, Steve Johnson, a friend of mine who I call the grandfather of product management training. He says some people have called him the godfather. And he says if he had a nickel for every time a company would come to him and say, we just finished this product. Now go find us some customers. And they can't tell you, now I'm adding to that, and they can't tell you who their customer is that they built the thing for.
Right.
So I find it essential to not do this ready, fire, aim approach that a lot of venture capitalists tell startups and other companies without at least having a general idea what direction you're going to be firing in. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole purpose of putting together the product market strategy.
So there's 24 elements there, which is probably way more than we want to talk through in the short time we have together. But where do you get started in that? You said most companies, they completely skip the first several. What are the key elements in there that you would highlight right now?
The first one is understanding what the customer does. Hmm. So I call it do. Some people like Tony Ulrich at Synergym talks about outcome-driven innovation and that people do jobs. They do jobs, but let's suppose my job is to go from here in Saratoga, California to downtown San Jose for lunch. Well, there's a lot of things I have to do in between. I got to get dressed. I got to groom myself. I got to find my keys. I got to find my car. I have to figure out how to get there. I have to check on the traffic. All of those little do's are things that affect my ability to get that job done for whatever outcome that I'm trying to accomplish. So I recommend people do two things. One is they drop down to the lower level of what do people do and understand why they do it, when they do it, how they do it, where they do it, what's holding them back. And then the way they gather that information, the second point is they don't ask them, what do you want to do? Because we all know most people can't tell you what they want to do. But what you do is you act like a social anthropologist, like a designer. You observe. You don't stick yourself into the scene. You don't affect it. You observe what they're doing. And this is what Procter & Gamble has been doing for decades, is they'll go out and observe what people are doing, like when they're doing their laundry. And then you put together a set of interview questions of that person. Why did you do that? Why did you do it? When? Where did you do it? How do you do it? And how satisfied are you with whatever things you've got to help you get that do done? Uh-huh. Because then you can begin to identify what the opportunities are. The key thing is, as Tony talks about, is you got to come up with 15 unmet needs in order to then build a product. And once you have those 15 unmet needs identified, then you know you've got your value proposition done and everything else after that flows. But most people start with maybe the product positioning, and that also is done generally wrong because they haven't figured out in the positioning what is it that people find are valuable, which is the value proposition, and you don't know what the value proposition is until you know what they want to do.
I like how you summarize all this and just do, right? Understanding what the customer problem is and what creates value for them. And I've talked with Tony a couple of times. He's been on the podcast also. And he really has kind of created a math of, you know, a formula way of looking at innovation. And he came up with that 15 unmet needs to kind of relate to how much more value do you need to create than your competitors are creating, right? For your product right. to get any attention. And it's a good way of looking at what we need to do for customers. And I love ethnography, that area of observing the customer. And we get so much more richer insights when we start there. So I appreciate you sharing that too. So that's some of the elements of strategy. That takes us to P, which is process. What kind of processes are involved in making insanely great products?
Well, you need to have a repeatable process and move up on the maturity scale. And the consequences of not doing that is one of my clients, former VP of product management, he was with a company when he retained me as a consultant, and they had developed five Wi-Fi devices, shipped them, and they all failed in the marketplace. Uh-huh. And he asked me to come in to assess what they're doing and then help him write a product management lifecycle framework for that particular company, for that market, and for their products. And his comment was, if you don't have a process, then you develop a culture of blame. because they would do their retrospect after the product shipped, and they'd all sit around and point fingers at each other saying, well, if you hadn't done it that way, blah, 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 blah. Whereas if they have a process, they could then fix the process so that the next time they go through it, they don't make the same mistakes again.
Right. It reminds me of this old management proverb, there are no bad people, only bad processes.
Exactly. And that's why my favorite quote is my own, the process is the product.
That's a good quote.
Which builds on Marshall McLuhan's "The media is the message." And part of that has to do with having a good product lifecycle framework. And there's one that I've developed that's on my website. It's available for free download. And the difference between it is I analyzed the product management lifecycle processes from like AIPMM, mm-hmm. from the 280 group, from Pragmatic, from Adaptive Marketing, from two or three others. And they're missing on eight cylinders. For example, almost none of them even bother to mention Agile. Many of them are focused more on the product launch and on the marketing. And there's a blog article on my website about the eight failures of those product life cycles, such that if you follow them, you significantly increase your prospects of failure.
That's important for us to make note of. I'll put that link in the show notes too, the link to your framework. But tell us real quick where we could find that.
It's on my website, and it's a product lifecycle framework, and it's available as a free download.
Okay. And the website is Spice Catalyst?
SpiceCatalyst.com.
Great.
One word.
Great. So Everyday Innovators, we can go out and find that. Obviously, I'll put that in the show notes. That will be at theeverydayinnovator.com/111. So process, key thing there is the repeatable process.
And the framework.
Yes. And so we know what the process itself is. And by being repeatable, then we can make improvements to it over time also.
Right.
Do a better job as time goes on, which is what we want to do as product managers, have more successful products more often. So the next up is I, which is information. What's the information that product managers need to be aware of?
Well, they need to have access to the information they need when they need it in order to get the job done. Mm. I was consulting for a big networking company in the services area, and I needed some information from the Central Market Research Group. And there was a 9-month engagement, and they said to me, the Market Research Group, great. This is like in February. They said, well, the budget comes up in July. We'll get it approved then, and it'll take us a few months to decide who we're going to buy. So we can get you your market research reports in about 18 months. So you start flying blind then, and like Steve Johnson says, it's all based on what the highest paid person, Hippo, I think he calls it, mm-hmm. the highest paid person's last opinion, as opposed to real data and real information. Information, for example, in terms of what your customers want to do, what is the different buying personas, what are the personas are that you built the product for, that all has to be available so that when the president comes back from that dinner meeting with their biggest customer and says, okay, tell the entire engineering team to stop what they're doing now. They have to do this feature over here. And then they go chase that feature. And then another customer of mine that I was consulting with, he says, well, we're sales driven and we don't hold the sales guys accountable or the president. If they come back and say, you got to build XYZ feature and you got to have it by ABC time, and they build it and then nothing gets sold. So if you have the information about what your customers want to do, how to do, when to do, and so forth, you could say, okay, they're saying they got to have this thing, but here's what we've agreed upon that we have found from our market research. Where does that fit in on the map? Huh. And then you can hold back on that.
And I was chuckling a little bit as you were sharing the customer stories, because I know that those are real stories, right? They're not just...
Oh, yeah.
There are things that you can point to that actually happened. And unfortunately, that's the case when you have a senior stakeholder involved that hasn't been tight to the project over the time. You don't have all the data you need. At the very end, things can suddenly change on you in ways that you don't want.
Exactly.
Don't serve customers either. You mentioned salespeople in that. There seems to often be some tension between product management and sales in organizations. And part of that comes because salespeople are allowed to go out and basically offer features that don't exist yet, and then expect product management to create them. Any best practices there to help out with resolving that tension?
I think there's at least three things. First is if you're at a large organization, find the leading salespeople and break bread with them. Breakfast, lunch, or dinner, because that's the way you get to know each other and try to find out what motivates them. With salespeople, it's fairly easy. It's called money. And the second thing that motivates them is Ohm's law. They follow the path of least resistance. So you got to make it easy for them. So if you're giving them all the stuff that they need to do their sales presentation and close the deal, and I mean all of the sales collateral, including return on investment analysis, proposals, and so forth, then their ability and need to go out there and sell stuff that doesn't exist goes down significantly. Mm-hmm. So first is get to know them really, really well. Second, make sure you've done your due work. So when you train them on your product, you could say, look, we went out and observed 40 people, and they all said, all of these are the things that they want to do, and here's how our product does that. So the odds of the sales guy finding something new is going to be very, very small because you've done your homework.
Good. And if they do find something, then it's also you have some evidence to suggest that that's not a mainstay requirement that we need to be focusing on right now.
Exactly. And that is also inherent in the reason why this voice of the customer stuff that's running around, it's become almost as popular as growth hacking, is that you're talking to the customer and the customer doesn't know what they want. They don't know what the problem is. They're not sure because they haven't thought about it, and they shouldn't be trying to solve their own problem with your product. And I suspect a lot of products are being misdirected by this voice of the customer.
Yeah, voice of the customer sometimes gets interpreted literally as the voice, you know, where we're, you know, more
like God.
Yeah, right. And more generally, we're trying to just gain those insights of what's important to the customer. And as you said with doing those observations, the ethnographic research is such an important place to start with. Okay, so we know some of the information also centered on customer needs and understanding the customer. This takes us to, I guess, the C, which is customers, right? So what more specifically do we want to know about customers?
Well, need to understand their personas, their motivations, what they want to do, where they live, and they need to be defined in more than just demographics, which is what the tendency is, the firmographics, the ethnographics, and the genographics, in addition to their geographic location, their cultures, their buying processes, and the impact on them of the social, political, economic, environmental, and technical changes that are occurring in the marketplace and each of those different marketplaces.
Okay, so there were a lot of terms in there. So let's break this down a little bit. So when it comes to marketing segmentation, you know, kind of the big four buckets traditionally are the demographics, you know, how old you are, how much money you make. The geographics, where you live, makes sense for restaurants, you know, retail operations sort of thing. The psychographics, like, you know, what do you like? Where do you tend to go? That sort of things. Buyer behavior and trying to group people together with similar buyer behavior. There was one that you said, which I'm not as familiar with. Was it firmographics?
Genographics.
Genographics was one. And then there was another one in the middle there. What was that one?
Probably firmographics,
yeah.
Which is, yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell us about those.
Cisco uses that in order to help target their sales force on what the nature is of the firms that they're calling on rather than the individuals.
Okay, so this is kind of a B2B segmentation.
It's the equivalent of demographics for B2B.
So that's helpful, and it makes sense if you're in a B2B setting like Cisco would be,
right,
to have an organization way to organize your segments for your B2B customers. Okay. And then a lot of those environmental factors, which like a tool like Pestel, which just looks at the different environmental factors for customers, certainly could be helpful too. In your experience with that, I've always found trends to be a key thing that sometimes gets missed in that environmental study, just what's surrounding the customer. What have you found about trends and recognizing those and the like?
I haven't spent a lot of time on it, although I do have a degree in interdisciplinary engineering from the University of Michigan, which included technology assessment. Hmm. And that's when we looked at the social, political, environmental, economic, and technical changes that are going on. And I co-authored a study by the Engineering Foundation on the barriers to technological innovation, a conference that we put on out in Sylmar, California. So I haven't been following it a lot. But I think if you just think through what changes are occurring, for example, the elimination of the small denomination bills in India.
Right.
How's that going to change stuff and the people's ability to buy your product? If Trump is successful in launching a trade war with China and a few other countries, how's that going to affect your product? Right. So I think you got to sort of like a war game thing. Look at what trends are happening in each of these areas and then project what its impact might be on your product, almost like doing a SWOT analysis in each of these areas.
That's certainly a useful tool for this to help you have that kind of bigger picture and get out of your own way a little bit and just see what's going on in the world around you. You know, like electric vehicles seem to be making a little bit of noise right now. And in 10 years, what we're driving for vehicles might be very different for the mass of the population than what it is now.
Well, that's a good example, self-driving vehicles. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, you got this capital resource, your car, that sits idle most of the time.
Right.
Not effective use of capital resource. What if I could push a button and release my car to go run around town and make money for me on the capital that I invested? Mm-hmm. What's that going to do to the taxi cab and the public transportation networks where someone else is put in that capital? They're going to be replaced. And I started thinking about just that little area there, parking structures. You won't need as much parking required in our cities. And then as I read more about it in San Francisco, developers are buying up parking structures with the intent to convert them to office buildings and residential in the future. And then just last week, the MIT School of Innovation, I forget what they call it, they put together an algorithm as to what would happen if we went to self-driving cars. And they project that 75% of the cars will come off the road. So that means we don't have to spend as much money as we have been spending on road infrastructure and on and on and on. So that is going to be huge changes, and it looks like it's going to happen pretty quick.
And time for us to see it for sure.
Yep.
Neither one of us are particularly young anymore, but thankfully medical trends are also in our favor. So this is very good. One of my kids might not even get a driver's license, right? That's a possibility that we might have self-driving cars in time that it just isn't important anymore.
Exactly.
It'll be interesting to see. Okay, so I sidetracked us a little bit there, but that was looking at customers and things we need to understand specifically about the customer. I appreciate that you brought in this bigger picture, you know, the environment the customer is in and some of the factors that might impact that and that we should be thinking through that. Anything else on customers we should talk about?
That's a good coverage of it.
Okay. So,
of course, if anybody wants any more on this, they can pick up my book,
Building
Insanely Great Products.
Absolutely. You know, like, you know, to dive into the 24 elements of strategy, obviously there's lots of meat here that we're leaving out. So spices, we got strategy, process, information, customer. That takes us to the E. The E is employees.
And the key there is to make sure that you have people with all the competencies, all of the skills necessary to build insanely great products. And I was a little surprised Wiley contracted with me to write a series of textbooks on product management and product marketing. Uh-huh. But since nobody knows what a product manager does, and if I go to a cocktail party and a nice looking lady says, well, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm a product manager. They usually turn and walk away. So the name of that series is Foundations in the Successful Management of Products.
Okay.
So now I say I'm a product success officer, and I think we should change the title from product manager to product success, vice president of product success, group director and manager of product success, product success manager, whatever you call it, but get product success in there because that's really what we do. We're responsible for the product success. Well, we have customer success officers. They used to be called salespeople.
Right.
We have customer experience officers, and they used to be called VP of support, and so on. We've changed everybody's name to some other name, which is more friendly than the line positions that we've had in the past. So we ought to be success managers, product success managers.
Yeah, I like that. Product manager, the, you know, It's not that managing is boring. Managing is a fundamental aspect of organizations. And, you know, Gary Hamel's done a lot of work to really make a strong case that the most innovation that we've seen over the last 150 years has been in management. But it doesn't really, like you said, at the dinner party, it doesn't conjure up. Being a product success officer is much more empowering.
Yeah, and I disagree with that statement that the biggest thing we've done in management, we haven't gone much beyond railroads in terms of management.
There's hopeful pockets, aren't there? So,
Well, we did have the HP Way, which was a very hopeful pocket, but that got overwhelmed by Alfred Sloan's mixed up accounting systems, which says inventory is an asset and people, we're talking about employees, are a liability. And employees have to have, I found in the research for my books, 130 different discrete sets of competencies or skill sets. And then a year ago last December, New York Times did a piece on the 200 schools of entrepreneurship in the United States, teaching hundreds of thousands of students on how to be entrepreneurs. And then I did a comparison of these 130 competencies that a product success officer has to have and the organization as a whole has to have against the things that entrepreneurs have to do. And I only found about six more things. So a product success officer does all but about six things that an entrepreneur does. So I have a blog on my website which shows all the competencies that you need to have in a triangle, product marketing success, product management success, and entrepreneur, with the six entrepreneurial ones at the top. And the name of the blog is Entrepreneur is Just French for Product Manager.
Product Success Officer and Entrepreneur is Just French. Good. And I'm making a note to make sure I get that in the show notes too, because that sounds like a really interesting blog for us to read. There's certainly lots of, well, as you found it, with so many of the skill sets in common between entrepreneurs and product managers. When I ask product managers why they got into product management, you know, what were they looking for? And a lot of those entrepreneurial type activities and mindsets always come up, right? And wanting to have some control over a product that make customers happy and a little bit more, you know, control over their own destiny in that sense too. So lots of similarities. And I think it's a very viable approach for entrepreneurs to go find the resources of a company and help that company and use those resources to help customers, as opposed to just thinking about entrepreneurship sometimes in that startup mentality that you're starting up more, you know, you and a partner or solo and the like. So
there's an important note in there I'd like to mention, and that is a lot of product managers I've talked to, they whine about the fact that they've got the responsibility but none of the authority. If you go back to the beginnings of product management, which was in 1932 at Procter & Gamble, and you read the memo that Neil McElroy wrote about brand managers, brand managers had the authority. They were the general manager of the brand, the promise, which was the product. And they had budgetary authority. So I recommend when companies set up or they change their product success departments, sort of like what Apple has done, and they give P&L responsibility and let the market research at the corporate level or at the local level come out of the product success officer's budget. And that, if I had had that with that company I was consulting with, then they would have gone out and bought the research right then and there rather than holding me up to the bureaucracy. The budget for all the marketing should be managed by the product success officer. The budget for all the PR and so forth down the list. Give them the authority to get the job done. And that's what happened to me when I was at Apple, where I was being held responsible for the Apple III product line. I had all the responsibility, but not the authority. And the whole story is in Building and Selling Great Products. I asked for the authority and they gave it to me. And then I was able to generate enough profits to fund Steve Jobs and his Macintosh through that whole development. And then after I shut down the product line, because the rest of the company couldn't understand that there was a small and medium business and a small office and home office market, which is what the Apple III was targeted at. And so we had to shut the product line down because we couldn't get the rest of the company to support it. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 to 1,500 employees lost their jobs because those profits had gone away.
Yeah, there always is the that tension with product managers who don't have the actual authority, but all the responsibility. And that's a pretty good story that you asked for the authority and got it. And maybe more product managers that have that level of influence should be doing the same thing and become product success officers.
Right. And here's how. There's a PowerPoint-like presentation. I think it's in Google Docs, Google Slides, available for free on my website. Mm-hmm. And the title of that blog is Quit Whining and Ask for the Authority. Hmm. And it's a generic template that people can go put in there, their argument to their management to give them budgetary authority.
Yeah, which could be a whole other conversation for us to have, no doubt. Because I think a lot of product managers, even though we complain about this, it also insulates us from some responsibilities, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, but let's stay on track for spices here. So we got employees. That takes us to the final letter, the S, which is systems. I think you said systems and tools officially. And we talked a little bit about this and what you described it before in terms of like being able to find the latest version of a document is a pretty important system. Tell us more about systems that you've ran into that are really important.
You can't get your job done unless you have the right system. Example of that is I was trying to put on a promotion for the Apple III when I was at Apple, and my distribution manager was a lady by the name of Donna Dubinsky. She later went on and founded Palm Computing, which became very, very popular, and she became very, very rich. And she said to me, I cannot run that promotion because our Ask Man system won't let us do it. I said, well, look, I'm being held responsible for sales of the product line. I don't care what system you're using. Fix the system. Right. Change the system. And if you have the wrong tools, you can't, and you use the wrong tools as an excuse as to why you can't get the job done, then you got a problem.
Right.
So only recently, the product manager has been relegated to Microsoft Word, which is horrible for collaboration. Excel, which they tend to use for project management, but it was never designed for that. God knows what documentation management systems they use. I used to work in the manufacturing documentation space where revision control and management and where used was absolutely essential between the bill of materials and which products that particular part goes into. Mm-hmm. The problem is massive. So I was explaining this to one of my product management students, and he works for a company called AdTech in India, which is a premier Atlassian developer, Jira developer. So I coached him on the product management of developing such a product, and he's finished it. It's a Jira plugin. It's available for free now. And again, you can get information on my website. And you get a dashboard, which will have your product management lifecycle framework. We've got a couple, three of them in there right now. So you just pick those and change them to whatever you want. And then under each of the issues, like personas, you can attach to it the personas for the buyer, the personas for the influencer, the personas for the user. And if someone needs access to it, they just go to that dashboard and there's the latest version. And of course, Jira does all the revision control and management for you. And once you figure out what your workflow is through each of these tasks, senior management can go look at the status of the product by looking at this one dashboard and see what things have been done and what things have not yet been done in the entire product lifecycle. And the name of the product is called Productize.
Productize. And also, do you have information on this on your blog?
Yes.
Okay. I will find that and include that in the show notes.
And then you can download the plugin from the Atlassian Marketplace for free right now. And if you don't have Jira available or a Jira administrator, then we can give you a cloud instance of what we have, and you can work with it.
Okay, great. So that takes us through spices, the structure, wrapping up there with systems and tools a little bit. I know we can dive into a lot more detail on systems and tools too. But it is comforting that we're seeing some shift, as you've indicated, right, from these tools that were not meant for specifically for product managers like Word and Excel into systems that are helping us get our hands around this better.
Well, I should mention that Steve Johnson has developed something called the Under 10 or Over 10 Playbook. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what it does, but I think it's more along the lines of the document management of the artifacts. And then there's a road mapping program out there called AHA. Mm-hmm. And there's another one, I think it's Product Plan, which is also does road mapping. The problem with that is the roadmap is only one of the 24 elements in a product market strategy. AHA is beautiful, makes doing a roadmap really, really easy. Mm-hmm. But again, that's only 1/23 of the problem.
Yeah, still certainly useful. It increases the collaboration inside the organization about products for sure, and makes knowing where the most recent version of information is. Coincidentally, I had someone email me last night asking about AHA. I haven't used it myself, but I have investigated some of these, and people who are using it also share good feedback for road mapping. So do you have any plans then to try to add plugins here to build out maybe more tools for your 24 elements of strategy?
Well, they are all in productized.
Okay, they're all there. Well, this is pretty important to know about then.
And then for each of those elements, there's a link to a video that will teach people how to do it.
Okay.
Which are the same videos that are in my Udemy courses, my online courses.
And right now this is available for free?
Yes.
Do you happen to know, since we're talking about this so much, happen to know the URL for the best place to go get more information on that?
Not off the top of my head. We're okay. In the process of setting it up. It might be productize.spicecatalyst.com. But we're fooling around with the SSL certificates, and my engineering team hasn't figured that out yet.
Yeah, I understand how that goes.
So it will either be that or spicecatalyst.com/productize. Worst case, send me an email, and I can get it back.
Yeah.
If you have Jira already, just go to the Atlassian Marketplace and look up productize, download it, and you're all set.
And again, I'll make this easy for listeners. If you just go to the show notes over to innovator.com/111, I'll make sure a link gets put in there, because we should have this figured out by the time this is actually published for people to listen to.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for walking through SPICES and that structure for thinking about what are the key elements for building insanely great products. And again, those are detailed in your book, same name, Building Insanely Great Products. And I always ask guests for an innovation quote. You shared one kind of at the beginning that maybe you want to go back to, but I'll give you the opportunity to pick. What is the innovation quote that you like, and why did you choose that one?
I like Helmut Essinger's quote, which is the title of his book called Keep It Simple. Hmm. And Helmut was the designer that did Sony Style in the 70s, became very, very popular. And Steve Jobs liked him so much that he hired him as Frog Designs. And I met Helmut when he revealed his Snow White language, design language, to Apple. I was in the same room with Steve and the other senior product managers. And I brought out to market some of the first designs for the Snow White design. And he says, keep it simple. And one of the things is this intersection between design, innovation, and product management. And we did that all the time. We just didn't define it as separate things. So I just spoke last October at the Productized conference in Lisbon, Portugal. And it was a design and product management conference. And it's amazing how much, as I traveled around Spain and Portugal, of interest in design. And a good designer does the same thing that a product manager or a product success officer has to do. They go out and observe, mm-hmm. and then they design things around that.
There's lots of collisions between people that are doing a good job of focusing on the customer and understanding their needs and that world of design and user experience. And another one I've been studying some of the last couple of years is copywriting. People that really want to understand the customer's aspirations and their pain, what they're struggling with. These are all people really important to what we do as product managers, and skills we need to have too. And in the process, we need to keep it simple, which is a great quote to share, especially given your time at Apple, because that seemed to have been a mantra too for Apple with Steve Jobs.
Yes, especially after he came back.
Thanks for walking through SPICES, sharing a little bit of the information from your book, Building Insanely Great Products. How can people find out more about the work that you're doing now?
The starting point would be the spicecatalyst.com website. Sign up for the blog or the newsletter there. Second is connect with me on LinkedIn. So you'll see my posts on LinkedIn. Uh-huh. Third, follow me on Twitter, which is DavidFraden1 on Twitter. And I'll be putting out a lot of information in the next few months along the same lines of the things that I've just described.
Very good.
I could close by saying that about 40% of all products that are ever shipped fail in the marketplace. And that's primarily because all the things we talked about earlier and everything I talked about in my books is not being done. And that represents about $0.6 trillion worldwide that's wasted each year. If we can just increase the level of product success a little bit, it will significantly help people, help the environment, and help mankind.
It's a very important thing to accomplish, and it is why us as product managers, maybe now as product success officers, have such an important role inside organizations. David, thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
I appreciate you listening. If you haven't connected with me yet on LinkedIn, please do so. Just search for Chad McAllister, PhD, and you'll find me. I would love to receive a connection request from you. The show notes, with a summary of what we discussed, along with the links and resources mentioned, and even more, are all at theeverydayinnovator.com/111. Please check it out. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.